same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, because you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good, because people need food in their belly, need some drink for the dying in their throat, need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly.
Well, good morning. Welcome once again to the KBOO Food Show, a monthly feature on the Monday morning radio zine. My name is Bruce.
And I'm Kate.
Today, all about oil. We're going to have two features about olive oil and another about other cooking and eating oils. And we'll also play some music for you and talk about oil of a different kind, petroleum oil, as it relates to food production. So let's get right into it. We have interviewed a couple of people in the last few days about olives and olive oil. And our first interview is with, you probably know some about oil. Just one moment, I'm sorry. I'm not prepared.
Well,
Shame on me.
While Bruce is finding that.
Well, I am ready, Kate. Sorry about that.
Go for it.
Here's a little bit of background information on oil, and I'm going to read several selections during this interview, and they're from a book called Olives, The Life and Lore of a Noble Fruit by Mort Rosenblum, and I'll give you that information again at the end. Today, there are about 800 million olive trees in the world. China has 20 million, four times as many as France. Olive trees are found on six continents, but 90% of them fringe the Mediterranean. Italy springs to mind at the mention of olive oil, but Spain has more trees, a lot more. Spain has a lot more if you deduct the fictitious groves that Italians report to collect European Union subsidies. And oil labeled as Italian is often from Spain, Greece, Turkey, or Tunisia. Olives account for at least 200 million workdays a year, and perhaps 7 million families grow them for harvest. Many are weekend farmers who tend their great-grandfather's trees for the love of it. Others might own 100,000 trees. Worldwide, the oil and olive business adds up to a turnover that approaches $10 billion. Each year, the world consumes nearly 2 million metric tons of olive oil. In Greece, every man, woman, and infant averages 5 gallons per year. Elsewhere, the numbers are climbing fast as more people acquire the taste. In America, the recent annual increase has averaged 12%. With each new survey, doctors are more enthusiastic about the nutritional value of olive oil. Monounsaturated, it drives off the bad cholesterol without reducing the good cholesterol. Unlike animal fat, it does not linger in the body as a cancer risk. Evidence shows it wards off certain cancers. It aids digestion, helps children grow, and retards aging in the bones, joints, and skin. Used alone, the word olive is hardly more specific than grape, and olive oil is as nuanced as wine. The Olea Europaea comes in at least 700 cultivated varieties, or cultivars, and each produces a different sort of fruit. So those are a few basics. Now, one thing everybody knows is that you can't grow olives in Oregon. Well, that's now wrong. Oregon now has a couple who is growing olives. They started a few years ago, and they are making oil. And I interviewed one of them. Their names are Larry and Dawn Monaghan. They live in Kaiser, and they're naming their business Victory Garden Olive Grove. And I talked with Larry the other day, and here's what he had to say.
My wife and I, we got interested in growing olives because we like the health aspect of it, as far as no cholesterol being in the oil. We also like the taste of it, and especially with a certain variety that we have. The main variety has a very nutty, fruity type of flavor to it. And we, as we're doing more research into growing the trees, working with trying to figure out which trees are more suitable for our type of climate, we also became aware of several issues as far as labeling and being truthful with the label on the bottles, how to store your olive oil in bottles, and which ones to look for in the store. We have an interest as far as kind of educating the public, and once we get our oil hopefully on the market for sale, then people can look at it. They know when the oil was harvested, possibly when the oil was bottled. If you look at many of the varieties that come from other countries, there is no labeling on there that says when oil was harvested. So you may have an actual product that is 2 years old or 3 years old, because there's no date of when it was harvested. Where ours, we're looking at being up front, this was harvested in 2005, 2004. You'll know on the bottle just by looking at it.
Is there a general rule of thumb, the fresher the better?
Yes.
You've spent most of your adult life in doing other things than farming. Is this actually your first farming experience?
This is actually my first farming experience, working with olive trees and planting them, setting up irrigation and getting greenhouse part of it, getting those aspects going, yes.
Well, how have you been learning? How have you been able to acquire information about olives and about farming and the whole thing?
Well, specifically in regards to olives, it is a case where when we checked locally for any information, how to grow olives, how to plant them, what type of irrigation to set up, the information here in Oregon available for that through the Oregon Ag Department, through OSU Extension Service, there's basically no information available. And the only way that we learn is by traveling out of state to the state of California and taking courses at UC Davis and one of the other colleges down there, as well as touring olive groves in the state of California and picking up information from the people down there, which I consider are experts. How they do certain things down there, we may have to adapt and do a little bit different, as well as certain types or varieties of trees that we may plant may not be the same ones that they're planting down there, just because of the climate conditions that we have up here.
Well, let's talk about the varieties. What varieties have you planted, and why have you chosen the ones that you've chosen? I know there's more than one.
Yes. We have basically two trial blocks that we have set up with 80 trees. In those 80 trees, we probably have approximately 40 different varieties from 8 different countries. Some of those, they do seem to fare better than others, like Frantoil seems to be a good variety. But the main block of trees that we're concentrating on is a variety called Arbequina. And it's a small Spanish variety that is very tasteful. It's a nutty, fruity flavor that is very appealing to one's taste, I think, anyway. And it's good for salads and it's good for cooking as well.
Do you plan to blend oils in your finished product?
I think eventually, once we get more information, more data on which trees are suitable for our type of climate, like right now we have you know, the severe coldness going right on, that we, once we find out which trees can survive this type of climate, then that is a possibility. And I'm sure to get a different flavor than that nutty fruity one that has a little bit more of a sharp taste to it, then yeah, we will be looking at that, as well as doing some mixtures with lemon oil and different type of oils along that line as well.
We've talked about the climate. What other challenges are you, have you run into, or do you expect to run into, as far as pests or diseases?
The one thing good about olive trees here that we haven't seen that they have a major problem in California, and that is with olive fly or the olive moth. Because I think of the coldness that you have here that we're experiencing right now, it would be hard for those type of pests to survive in the dirt. The only thing that we've seen as a problem with pests, and that is with deer, you know, coming in and eating on the trees.
Are you using pesticides, herbicides, anything like that?
The two chemicals that we use on our place is one is copper spray that we use on the trees to help protect them from the cold that we're having right now. And the only other item that we're using, which is on the field, trying to control weeds, and that's similar to a Roundup type of spray on the ground. As far as controlling bugs or pests of that nature, we don't apply anything on that.
You're fairly new in this. Can you tell me what year you planted your first grove, and how many groves you have now, and how many trees or how many acres?
We have, our first planting was in 2002, and that basically started our two trial blocks. Since then, we have planted our main orchard in 2003-2004, and slowly filling it in. We have approximately 2 to 2.5 acres of arbicina. And the planting of those is what they call, it's a new system, not the standard 12 by 12 or 12 by 14 planting, as far as the
spacing
of the trees and the spacing of the rows. In the high density, they're planted a lot closer together, and so the trees are only 5 feet apart from one another and the rows 12 feet. So with the idea of this, one of the things that California has ran into is the cost of labor. And a lot of times to bring people in and pick the trees, that's very costly. By going to a high density and a special variety as arbicina, these rows can be actually machine harvested with a modified grape harvester. And so it'll just straddle the row, and it has arms that go along and knock the fruit off, and then it's taken out that way mechanically, and it saves a lot of time.
Your first production of olive oil, I think, was at the end of 2004.
Well, what we have right now is actually just like last year, we did a hand picking of them. We did major pruning last year to trying to get the growth that we desire. Consequently, we cut back a lot of the branches that had potential fruit on it, but still after the pressing, and right now we have a labor intensive press, which is kind of like the way they did it in the old days with a hydraulic press and getting oil out of the fruit and the paste. And so we only ended up with about 2 gallons of it. This coming year, we are looking at purchasing a mill that is food gradable, where hopefully where we can start bottling some of the oil and possibly selling it in the near future.
Yeah, I guess being the first olive growers in the state, it means that there's also not anyone who's going to press them for you.
That is correct. And it's one of those where we want to remain kind of a cottage industry where we do the picking, we do the pressing on site. We're also hoping that once we get a mill set up on site, then hopefully we can work with a community and have like community pressings, you know, at a certain time of the year where people can bring the fruit in, and we can work together on pressing that and giving some back to them, or giving it back to them, you know. So we're excited, and we think the olives will grow here, and it's fun, but a lot of work.
Larry Monaghan from Victory Estates Olive Orchard, thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome, and look forward to listening to the program. And if anybody has any questions, they're more than welcome to give us a call.
And the phone number?
It's area code 503-393-2128.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Larry Monaghan, who with his wife Dawn Monaghan owns Victory Estates Olive Orchard in Kaiser, Oregon. I renamed it at the beginning of that piece. I apologize for that. It's Victory Estates. One thing that didn't come out in the interview very clearly was that they have actually, even though most of their olives are of two varieties that he mentioned, they have trees with 40 different olive varieties, and they have planted over 1,200 trees total. Well, there's another family in the Portland area that is actually a few years ahead of the Monaghans in dealing with olives. The name is Rosenberg, and they have a business called the Olive Farm, which you may have seen or heard of their retail store on Southeast Milwaukee Avenue. It's also a wholesale operation and a grower and an importer and an internet operation. And I talked with Kurt Monaghan recently, and here's the beginning of our interview. How did you and your family get involved in olives?
Well, my parents basically fell in love with Turkey and their travels. They went there and kind of fell in love with the culture, the history, and the cuisine. And upon sale of the family business here in Portland, they started this business in Turkey. There were olives around and available, and they had the idea that maybe they could take the olives and make wonderful olive oil from it.
When was this?
This whole process started about 1995. We didn't actually build the olive oil mill till later, but we actually harvested some of the olives on our property and took it to a nearby communal olive press, and we made olive oil there. They would make olive oil for us, and we'd take it back to the farm, and then we would bring it to the United States to our friends. And our friend said, "This is the best olive oil we've ever tasted." So my father, sensing that there was a possible business here, built an olive oil mill. And he got together with the number one olive oil equipment man in Turkey. And it was a very exciting process where they got together and wanted to make olive oil in the most natural way using the most state-of-the-art equipment. And it's considered one of the finest olive oil mills in the Mediterranean. It's absolutely beautiful, and it's state-of-the-art, and it makes a lovely olive oil that really does rival some of the best olive oils, whether they be from Spain or Greece or Italy.
Let's just talk about the processing. There's a lot of arguments about the best way, the way that leaves the most flavor in, and so on. You say state-of-the-art. What was wrong, or what is wrong, with the way a lot of folks have been doing it for thousands of years?
There are a couple things that keeps the reason they're kind of moving to this more technological olive oil making. Number one, the European community is now the EU, and they have very strict health standards. And so the old using the wheel that went around and made the original olive mash, that doesn't really go over real well now, especially when you're exporting out of the EU. Also, the old way of pressing is not a really a great way. It's not a very efficient way.
There are a lot of ways to press an olive. There are a lot of ways to press an olive. In most olive-growing countries, millers flavor the modern continuous systems, which use linked centrifuges to grind up pulp and at the end, spin out oil. The advantage is economic. In the traditional way, olives are crushed to an oily paste by a huge granite wheel, or sometimes two wheels. The mash is then spread evenly onto round, double-layered mats with holes in the center. The mats are woven with natural fibers and each is the size of a manhole cover. Millers stack these mats on a platform, placing them over a central steel pillar. Hydraulic power then squeezes this towering sandwich, and oily liquid runs down the side into decanting tubs.
What we did is we came up with a way to keep the olive oil very fresh and not damage it in the process and when it's being processed. And what it is basically is there are just these wonderful little blades that are extremely small that just chop it up very quickly, not generating a lot of heat, which can damage the olives and therefore damage the oil. We've actually, some of the slow food, raw food people like us because we manufacture oil at such a low temp. And that's extremely important to why olive oil will taste fresh. If they use heat or chemicals or anything like that to extract olive oil from the olives, it damages the flavor. The water content is extremely important too. You obviously want to extract as much water out of it as possible. You also want to extract as many foreign things out of the olives as you can too, whether it be stems or pits or those kinds of things to make a good olive oil.
Let's talk about the grading system.
Let me just say that you have to be a few things to be extra virgin, which is considered the top of the line. You have to, really the main test is it's called a free acidity test. It's like a pH test that you might have done in your lab, you know, when you were going to high school and college. And you want to make sure that you're below 1% free acidity. If you're not below 1% acidity, you're not extra virgin. In fact, you go over that 1%, that's when you become a virgin oil. If you go over 2%, then you have to be called pure. And I think even above 4 is something called Lepant or something. It's like oil that you'd use in lamps, that kind of oil. You have to make sure that it is picked and pressed within 24 hours. That's extremely important. The reason for that is if olives are left to their own devices, let's say you leave them for over 24 hours, they actually kind of crunch on each other in a bag or in a box or in a truck or whatever, and the acidity comes up. Well, therefore, you know, you just went above your 1%, and you're no longer extra virgin. You also have to be, you have to have one of three characteristics. You have to be bitter, pungent, or fruity. And those may sound like different things, but those are things you have to have one or a combination of those characteristics to be considered to be extra virgin. I'll just tell you quickly what pungent is. Pungent is that little burn you get at the back of your throat sometimes. That's by olive oil aficionados a great thing. Bitter is kind of, I'll use kind of the apple analogy here. Bitter is kind of like the green apple you get. You get that with like green olive oils. The reason you get that little bitter flavor is actually the green in the olive oils is chlorophyll. It's what you see in leaves. And if you've ever done chloroseptic, you get that kind of bitter feel. And fruity is like a red delicious apple. And that's just very fruity. And people actually, if they do an olive oil tasting, they say, this tastes fruity. It's very lush. It's very full-bodied. So those are three things you have to be. Now, you're automatically not extra virgin if you're rancid or if you taste like mothballs. Or actually, there's a word for that called musty fusty. And if you've ever tried a musty fusty olive oil, it tastes like mothballs. There's rancid. There's tinny. There is muddy, meaning they haven't cleaned out they didn't get all the dirt out of it when they were washing and stuff like that. Any of those things makes an olive oil no longer an extra virgin.
The International Olive Oil Council actually has a number of official words. First, there are styles: aggressive, assertive, or pungent, bitter, delicate or gentle, fresh, fruity, green, harmonious or balanced, rustic or earthy, spicy, strong, and sweet. Then there are aromas and flavors: apple, banana, lychee, melon, pear, ripe olive, tomato, eucalyptus, grass, flower, green leaf, hay, leafy, mint, herb, violet, avocado, almond, Brazil nut, and walnut, and chocolate. Now let's continue our interview with Kurt Rosenberg of the Olive Farm. You mentioned bitter. All ripe olives are actually naturally bitter, right?
That's correct. You have to have cured them. That's a good point. I can't tell you how many people that, like, friends of mine, like, grew up in California, and as kids, they went through an olive grove, and they grabbed an olive, like, they thought you could grab an apple. They have to be cured. So they are going to be bitter. Now, what's interesting, once you cure them, though, there's still going to be a level of fruitiness or bitterness based on when you've harvested them. Now, let's talk about that really quickly because it's important. When people come to me and they say, what's a good olive oil? I tell them it's what tastes good. It's really what tastes good to your palate. Well, they say, well, we've been told that the green oils are better. Well, I say, well, the reason that you believe that green oils are better is there just are a little few, are there more green olive oils out there? The reason for that is that most of the olive oils that you grew up with are Italian. Those folks harvested their olives earlier in the season, before the first frost, when the olives are green. They have to, in Tuscany, before the frost comes, they have to harvest. And the olive hasn't had a chance to turn into that kind of black, purple, fruity olive. And so you get green olive oil, and that's what Americans tend to be used to. Now, in other countries, you go farther south, maybe to Sicily, maybe southern Spain, Andalusia, or to Turkey. They don't harvest till another month later. That gave the olive a chance to ripen longer on the tree to that purple black that you see, you know, when you buy, you know, at an olive bar or something. And that is a totally different oil. In fact, that oil, when you see it on the shelf, is going to be that nice kind of straw-colored, golden-hued oil. And that tends to be fruitier because the olive has sat on the tree longer. Therefore, it's going to be a fruitier oil.
How do you cure an olive?
The best way to do it is that you basically, you put the olives in there with rock salt. And you cover it over, and they cure in rock salt for about 6 months at least. And that's how you cure them.
I understand your family has two orchards.
We do have two orchards, in essence. We've got one up on the Aegean coast in an area called Ibalik, which has been growing olives for 2,000 years. Then down at the farm. These are two different places. Our farm is actually, and mill is farther south. We have been planting olive trees that are a Memajek olive. And that is a more bitey, more rustic kind of wild-tasting olive. I guess it's just not as refined. And we're making olive oil out of that. We actually have an olive oil here at Olive Farm called Village, which is made out of the Memajek. And you can tell the difference. And I like it. I think it's very, the reason we call it Village is if you're driving through a village in Turkey and you stop at one of the communal olive oil mills, chances are you're going to get a Memajek oil. It's more prevalent. It's more round. The Ibalik olive is a more expensive olive, and it tends not to be as widely dispersed.
What do you do with the pulp? What do you do with what's left over?
Oh, well, this is very neat. We've done a couple things. We've taken the pulp, and we have made olive pulp burning logs out of them that you can burn in your fireplace.
They emit an
a beautiful, nice smell. Yeah, really nice. We also take the pulp. It's also called mash, by the way. And we use it in our hog fuel boiler to generate electricity for the mill.
If we buy the house brand of olive oil in an American supermarket, how is that different from your product?
Number one, they make the same olive oil. There's no difference in it. It's not really tied to the seasons and the harvest and all that. It's just bulk stuff. That doesn't mean it's not good, and actually sometimes it might be better to buy that for cooking, because when you cook with olive oil anyway, you're going to burn off most of the flavor. So it's fine. And there are some good olive oils out like that. Some folks actually blend it. They'll call it an extra virgin, but guess what? It's mostly virgin with a little dash of extra virgin in it to give a little flavor. You don't really know what you're getting sometimes with those olive oils. The other thing is, they don't get the care and feeding that our olive oil gets. When we make our olive oil, we put it into stainless steel tanks quite a bit below room temperature, 65, somewhere in there, 60 degrees, because olive oil doesn't like heat, light, or air. The other thing, then what we'll do, too, is once it's put into the tanks, then it comes across in the containers. to us in a climate-regulated container where we keep it below room temp, too. And then here at Olive Farm, we have cool rooms in the back, and we keep it cool below room temperature there to ship out to our mail order customers or our wholesale customers. The thing you don't know about store-bought is how long has it been on the shelf? How long has it been in their warehouse? You just don't know. Let me just also make a little recommendation to your food listeners. When you buy an olive oil, especially if you care about it, make sure that you keep it in the coolest, darkest place in your kitchen. I know a lot of folks keep it right by the stove, which is the hottest place to keep it. And now you can do that if you use a lot of olive oil and you're turning it over all the time. But I would recommend just find the coolest spot, and I'll promise you your olive oil will remain fresh and taste better over time.
You mentioned about some sellers will mix a bit of extra virgin with lower grades of oil and label it extra virgin. I also know that a lot of oil that is sold as product of Italy, actually the olives were grown in Spain or other countries. The Italians seem to have the international trading part of this business sewn up. The U.S., though, for a U.S. consumer, the U.S. is not a member of the International Olive Oil Council. And labels in the U.S., I suppose you could get away with saying anything if you wanted to.
You can get away with it, but you know what? Even being a member of the IOOC is no guarantee, because what happens in places like Italy and Spain, who are very big producers, they actually, a lot of their trees are gone now, so they blend with Turkish and Tunisian oils. It's the last country that actually puts their label on it that can say product of Italy. So you folks have had Turkish oil before, probably, and didn't even know it.
And then Kurt Rosenberg gave us a tour of the Olive Farm store.
Okay, well, we have in the store, we've got olive oils, and here, as you look, we've got the golden oil. See how gold that is? That is a late harvest oil. Remember I told you if you leave it on longer? Now, in Turkey, we kind of tricked Mother Nature. We actually harvested the same time as they would in Italy, and that's how we got this green early harvest olive oil. See how nice and green it is? That actually, the green you see there is chlorophyll. And also here is the village oil that we were talking about, which is the one with the Memecek olive that we're doing at the mill, you know, in the southern part on the Mediterranean. And that's a very rustic kind of full-bodied. It's a great oil, actually. And then we also do a blend just because we know people want to use these more expensive oils that we just talked about for their salads and their dressings. We came up with a cooking oil here. And it's an Olive Farm blend, and it's great. It has a higher smoke point, so it's great for sautéing and those kinds of things. We've got dried figs. We've got dried apricots. These are vinegars that are specialty vinegars that Olive Farm carries, like pear vinegar and black fig vinegar. We have herb packet spices that are they're my own blends, and they're good in, it kind of depends on what you want. We got ones that are good for salad, ones that are good for fish, ones that are good for dips. We're Olive Farm, so we have olives. It would make sense. We've got a pink olive, which is really a neat olive. It is, they harvest it right in the middle of the ripening phase, so it's got a little of the tartness of a green, but it's just going over to the fruity side. So it's really nice. We have a black olive, which is from Gemlik, which is closer to Istanbul. And that is if in the traditional Turkish breakfast, which usually has cheese and tomatoes and cucumber and tea, these black olives are a part of, this Gemlik olive is a kind of like a staple part of that that Turkish breakfast. We also have purees made from our from the olives, too. We have a green olive puree, like a tapenade, and we have a black tapenade, too. Along kind of the green idea, we didn't like the idea that we were pruning our trees and that we were burning the limbs, you know. So we make beautiful olive wood stuff out of them. We make toys and trays and trivets and magazine racks and all kinds of things out of it, and we make that right at the mill.
There's a lot of pruning in olives, isn't there?
There is. There is a saying in Turkey that you want to have a tree pruned enough that a bird can fly through it. And the reason for that, if you think about it, you want to make sure that the sun hits all the olives. So if you have to have pruned that much so that every olive gets some sun.
using olive oil in cooking and in dishes, whether you cook the oil or cold dishes, whatever, olive oil on bread. How common, how popular is it in Turkey as part
huge.
Of the cuisine?
It's a huge part. They use very little butter. It's really olive-based for that side of it. They use it for sautéing. They use it in their they drizzle it in their soups. It is used a lot in baking. They use it to bake cookies and some of their pastries. The consumption there is quite high, olive oil. It's a big part of their diet, huge part of their diet, huge part of that very healthy Mediterranean diet, which tends to be have the right kind of fats, which like olive oil is, and low protein, high fruit and vegetable. We have cooking classes here, and we feature some of the finest chefs in the Portland metro area in the Northwest. They're very informal. They're wonderful. You can talk to the chef. You can go up and watch them as they cook. It's always an interesting group because everybody has the same kind of interests. And during those cooking classes, we have you'll have some oil out for dipping and some olives, and then you get a light supper that's just been prepared. You can find our cooking class schedules on our website, and you can also call Olive Farm to get dates.
And Kurt Rosenberg also pointed out that olives can be used on the human body other than for food.
Well, the other thing that I think people wouldn't think about Olive Farm is actually we have another department that makes skincare products like hand creams, hand lotions, and liquid hand soap, stuff like that, that incorporates our olive oil. And olive oil has been a skincare product since ancient Egyptian times. It's very moisturizing, very soothing, very healing. So it's something people don't expect with Olive Farm, but they're beautiful, and they incorporate our own olive oil. And it's made right there at the mill as well. We're at the Olive Farm, 5120 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97205. We have a website, www.olivefarm.com, and you can call us here in town, 503-231-8651.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure having you.
Thank you very much, Kurt. That was Kurt Rosenberg of the Olive Farm in Southeast Portland. Well, we've heard about olives in Turkey and olives in Oregon, and I think we need to mention also that olives are grown in California. You probably knew that. California has an estimated 34,000 acres planted in olive trees, but for all our talk about olive oil, 80% of California's crop is for so-called pizza olives, those tasteless black slices that lurk in salad bars and free delivery delis. That includes canned olives, which are graded in size from large to gargantuan with a thyroid problem. Some green olives are produced, but most of those come from Spain or Morocco. California's specialty is the California ripe black olive, which is neither ripe nor black. It is picked green for firmness and skin texture. Lye quickly leaches out oleuropein. A bubble bath of ferrous gluconate turns the olive black. Flavorless brine embalms them for an almost indefinite shelf life. So those are California olives. Now, olives can get political. Olives can get political in places like Israel and Palestine. And I want to give you a few numbers of what happens to trees there. Olives are very important to people in that part of the world. And the Israelis know this. According to one Palestinian, if anyone throws a stone from a field, the Israelis push all the trees off. He says, we get punished for 1,000 years. He's referring to how long olive trees last, and they certainly do last hundreds of years and continue producing olives. He says, when Jewish settlers want to move into an area, they uproot the olives that denote possession. Olives actually denote possession of land. Or they plant new trees to mark their new ownership. Some statistics. From May 1993 to July 1995, about 2 years, there were 81 entries logged by the Palestinian Land and Water Office about olives and olive trees. Here are a few of them. In Kariut, 400 olive trees pushed down due to settlers' aggression. In Abud, 60 olive trees for throwing stones. In Jayus, 400 olive trees taken by an Israeli quarry. In Faraun, 15 olive trees for security reasons. In Beit Lead, 1,200 olive trees dug up, no reason given. The two-year total of 14,000 uprooted trees also included figs, almonds, peaches, and others, but mostly they were olives. That section, that selection, and others that I've read during this interview are from the book Olives, The Life and Lore of a Noble Fruit by Mort Rosenblum. This is available in the Multnomah County Main Library and also in the Vancouver Public Library. And another source to learn more about olive oil, how to enjoy it, and where to buy it, is a website. Here it is, www.oliveoilsource.com. That's oliveoilsource.com. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO in Portland. Coming up at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, a special program today, they'll be featuring readings from Howard Zinn's Voices of a People's History of the United States. So voices from my money, the best book on American history ever written.
By the Gnome Arts Council. The spread of reindeer, moose, king crab, smoked salmon, whale meat we dip in seal oil, Eskimo food which we wash with cold duck, Budweiser, Baller Tour Schnapps. Nothing special here. We speak of snow, wind, the nature of drift. We eat and drink as simply.
Fiddler and poet with Jerry Higgins, they're folks from Nome, Alaska. I just thought that was sort of a cute little piece of food info from Alaska. If you've been feeling the cold, windy, dehydrated air, just remember a couple of weeks ago it was pouring rain relentlessly, and I walked across southeast Portland to visit Green Machine Biofuels, who also press oil. Once there, I found more than just oil and rain. Bruce Marin and his partner Molly are urban farmers. Molly wasn't present for the tour, but she is very much a part of the operation and is especially working with some of the defatted products to try to find ways to use them aside from feeding the chickens. So the next piece is a tour that Bruce gave me of their facility, Green Machine Biofuels.
My name is Bruce Marin, and I am the founder of Green Machine Biofuels Incorporated. I produce organic seed oil. I'm very interested in developing an urban permaculture site, which includes not only manufacturing our oil, but also sustainable food production. Out front, we've got fig tree, almond tree, cherry tree, plum tree here, Gravestine apple here, grapes, berries in the back. Ultimately, chickens here. My dream, of course, would be to make it into a functioning year-round greenhouse for hydroponics. So we'll see if that happens.
Looks like you've got the water.
Yeah, we have plenty of water. Oh, my God, it's flooding. Per regulation, we have a separate entrance. We've got a more traditional cold storage area for garden produce and canned goods, just like in the old days.
Let's take a look at what foods you've got stored
over
here.
Yes, you've got I'm trying an experiment, actually, with zucchinis, which don't usually keep, but these guys are doing okay.
What are you going to do with those zucchinis?
Well, I don't know. But they're holding up. And then we've got canned goods from the gardens.
Are those apples?
Some apples, yeah, also kind of in an experimental stage. So I got at the basement and built a straw bale and cob room. And this is the rough cob. The texture is pretty rough. It's a little bit of cracking. There's straw in there. And you can kind of see the hay bales that underneath that. And then Lydia Dolman, who's a great natural builder, helped me do the final touches on this. And we put another coat of cob plaster, just a mud plaster with a lot of sand and paper pulp. And then I put linseed oil over that. So that makes it look real nice, kind of like an adobe finish. And so now we go into the production facility. Department of Ag certified.
Green Machine Biofuels.
Production. The sound you hear in the background is an expeller press that I'm operating in cold press mode. And I'm actually producing sunflower seed oil today. So the first thing is an expeller press. And that just means that the oil is extracted by mechanical means as opposed to chemical means, which would be solvent extraction, for example, or a combination of mechanical and solvent. But a straight-up expeller press just squashes the seeds and pushes out the oil.
Let's take a look at it.
Yeah, let's go look. What's happening here is that there's a hopper and there's a stainless steel auger that's rotating and dragging the seeds. There's a nozzle here that functions as a press head, and the seeds come up against that press head and get squished. And what you're seeing coming out, it's kind of like these little pellets of basically defatted sunflower seed meal. This is still very high protein, high nutrient, a lot of minerals. And then the oil comes out these little tiny holes here, and it drains slowly down into a stainless steel catchment tank, and then from there I'll let it sit and then bottle it. So this is cold press because I don't have a heating element on this part of the press, on the press head area. I could put a heater on here and it would raise the temperature. I would probably get a little bit more oil, but I would also lose a lot. I would denature wonderful essences, which are small organic molecules, and also potentially damage, maybe, some of the nutritional value.
Does the heat sometimes make them go rancid easier?
Anytime you apply that, you increase the molecular motion, which then, if there's oxygen available, it's going to oxidize that material faster. So, yes. My initial business vision was to produce biodiesel fuel, but I changed that and moved into production of the precursor, which is the triglycerides or the oil. This is the smallest model that this particular German company makes for oil production. The final product looks like. And here's a bottle of sunflower oil. That's our label, and then there's some information about what we are and what we do. This is the green man and a sunflower plant and a sesame plant. And this is an old Middle Eastern press, a yoke press. This one is a press from Nepal. Steve Harrington is a wonderful artist, and this is all original artwork.
The ingredients there are sunflower seeds.
That's it. Organic sunflower seeds.
I did want to ask you, though, where you get your sunflower seeds.
Sunflower seeds. currently from Azure Standard, which is a natural foods wholesaler in Duford, Oregon. But hopefully down the road a bit, I can get sunflower seeds grown in Oregon. On our label right now, per statute, we can't really say it's organic, even though I can say that the seed is organic, that the material is produced from. But hopefully this year also we'll be certified with Oregon Till. But there's a lot of record keeping. Here's my feedstock input, output on these dates. These are the oils I produced and how much I got, and a little code that I can track everything with. And also that ties back to when I get seed in, you have to track where everything comes from, and so that you can certify that actually, yes, it's organic and I haven't adulterated it in any way. And I should also mention that the oil is completely unrefined and unfiltered. I press it and let it sit a little bit and then bottle it right up. There's an amount of fine sediment, which is actually nut meat. You can kind of see it coming out here. It's not totally clear. That adds just a wonderful, wonderful flavor. When you cook with it, those little pieces of nut end up roasting slightly, and it's like, wow.
Is there another kind of oil that you're doing right now?
Yeah, right.
Just sunflower?
Yeah, right now we produce sunflower and sesame seed oil.
How much oil are you making?
A 25-pound bag of sunflower seeds will give me about 5 to 7 375-mil bottles. Sesame seeds are typically higher in oil, and I get about 8 to 10 bottles out of sesame.
My other question was about first pressings and second pressings, like with olive oils. Do you do additional pressings?
No, it's a one-shot deal with seed oils.
Could you?
No. The material that's coming out of the press now is pretty much defatted. I don't think you could get much out of it. Maybe if you solvent extracted, you might get a little bit. But
do you have a website?
We just started the business. We got actually into production late summer last year, and we were fortunate enough to get into the Portland Farmers Market, and that was a huge success. We did the market in the Pearl District and the big market Saturday market. So the website is up for this year.
The farmers market's closed for the winter. Are you marketing it somewhere locally?
We have it on the shelf at the Daily Grind, just down the street, and also at Food Front Co-op. And we're looking at probably doing some other farmers markets. We did the People's Farmers Market, I think, once or twice, but hopefully we can get on a regular schedule there.
People's goes year-round.
And People's goes year-round. And, oh, we got to get a tent.
Yeah, it's tough on those rainy winter days over at People's.
Yeah. Along the sustainability lines, along the bigger vision lines, Molly and I both are very much committed to local sustainable development. As a patriot, I am very deeply concerned about the state of American agriculture, which is completely fueled by petroleum, both in terms of its production cycle, including chemical-based fertilizers and pesticides, as well as equipment, and then transportation of the food. It's very apparent to me that all of our food needs are going to become increasingly local quite soon. We should taste the oil, too. Right?
Yum, yum. Fresh, premium-quality, cold-pressed, unrefined seed oil.
Give this one a try. All right. Well, this is spelt bread, so the spelt obviously has a little bit of a flavor on its own, but we should be able to.
Mm.
Yeah, it comes through. Tastes like tahini.
Definitely, it's nice.
I think that's also the vision, where it's something that we can do locally. I don't even have to bike to work. I am dependent still on seeds coming to us, but hopefully we'll get the sunflower seeds growing somewhere in Oregon. And but nut seeds are also in the future.
I was just going to ask you what your future seeds were.
Yeah, right. Pumpkin seed. I tried flax, which was going to be our next product. And oh my gosh, now I know why it's so expensive. I took 20 pounds of flax seed and I got about 3/4 of one of those bottles. That's it. And that was after some manipulation. And then the nuts, like hazelnuts and walnuts, both of which are crops grown here in Oregon.
I'm really happy to see this.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
Thanks for letting me come here today.
Oh, thank you so much, Kate. And, I hope everyone eats locally.
then, that was Kate's interview with Bruce Marin of Green Machine Biofuels. We have just time for one more brief story. This is from Reuters News Service. The Seattle-based Jones Soda Company ballyhooed a brand new holiday flavor this year following their past hits of turkey and gravy-flavored soda. The new drink features the flavor of salmon, or more specifically, smoked salmon. Peter Von Stolk, CEO of Jones Soda, told Reuters that his company's exotic offerings, such as green apple, bubblegum, and crushed melon, continue to sell well. But the new salmon drink? Von Stolk admits, "I cannot finish a bottle. I just can't."
Yeah, that's pretty gross, Bruce. Where'd you find that one?
I found that in High Country News, which is a favorite paper of mine that I've mentioned on here before, an environmental paper for people who love the West. Well, that's our show for this month. We'd like to say that we're having fun doing the show, but we do need more volunteers, and we think it's right if you would also participate in the show. Please contact the Food Show at KABU in mailbox number 7, or give a call and a phone message at 231-8032, although I'll caution you that today we don't have a receptionist on duty because of the holiday. Next month, we will be a little bit out of schedule. We're going to be on the fourth Monday rather than the third because we wanted to get involved in Pledge Drive. Yes, that's right. Our membership drive is coming up late in March.
So think about what you can give to your community radio station. And while you're thinking about what you can give, Bruce is going to tell us what we're going to do, right?
Right. This is rare. We actually know what we're going to do on our next show. We try and keep it timely, but this time we're planning ahead. We're going to have a call-in, that means you, and it's about restaurants in the Portland and the KABU listening area. Call in to tell us what your favorite restaurant is. That'll be on March 27th, Monday, at 10 a.m., Well, for today's show, we'd like to thank our engineer, Tammy Dean. We'd also like to thank Public Affairs Director Kathleen Stevenson and our guests, Larry Monaghan of Victory Estates Olive Orchard, Kurt Rosenberg of The Olive Farm, and Bruce Marin of Green Machine Biofuels. Stay tuned now for Democracy Now! With their feature from Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Community Radio.
A long and lanky, good-looking cowgirl walked into a cafe. I dropped my fork, cleared my throat, tried to get her to look my way. I thought I might could be in love. When I heard her say,
And the food show today was made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Food Front Cooperative Grocery, specializing in foods from local and organic producers. Food Front is located in Northwest Portland at 24th and Northwest Thurman. For more information, the number is 503-222-5658. And stay tuned now. Democracy Now! Is coming up next on your community radio station, KABU.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the third annual Oregon Queer Youth Conference. The conference is open to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transsexual, queer, questioning, and intersex youth and their allies under the age of 23 to get together, discuss the issues, and have a crazy cool time. The conference takes place at the Caitlin Gable School, located at 8825 Southwest Barnes Road, on Saturday, February 25th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information, go to www.oqyc.org.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 or on the web at radiocab.net.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
You know, our heroes are not the war makers. Our heroes are not Theodore Roosevelt, but Mark Twain. Not Woodrow Wilson, but Helen Keller.
Today we spend the hour with a dramatic reading of Howard Zinn's Voices of a People's History of the United States. With Josh Brolin, Viggo Mortensen, Sandra...